It's Learning to Listen with Quinn, Naomi, and Charlie.
Yes, it is L2L, the podcast, aka Learning to Listen. Thank you very much for joining us today. As you know, we're talking all about music and the way we listen to music. We're trying to engage with the music we listen to. So that's us, all about the lost art of engaged listening. That's why we're talking about albums and consuming the album as a whole artistic statement, the way artists intended. This isn't a biography show. So, you know, I don't know where you get that. Maybe A&E has been putting out podcasts. Go find those. But, oh, instead, this is just pure guttural and visceral reaction to the music that we are listening to. So, my name is Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. My co-hosts are here. DJ Charlie Scream.
Charlie Scream.
That seemed appropriate. And then, of course, our hostess with the mostest, Naomi Carmack. Naomi, how's it going?
Oh, I need to be fucking, yeah.
Wow.
Coming on strong.
Damn. Okay, Naomi. I mean,
it sounds like I'm really saying it live. You. Wow. Okay. Thanks.
I mean, you can't take it back now. Nope. Listen, guys, we are talking all about today's album, which is Passage by the Carpenters. That's right. You are listening to an edition of Bargain Bin.
It's a Bargain Bin, baby.
Yeah. So, you know, we've got staff picks. That's where the staff goes, hey, we recommend some of this stuff. This stuff is maybe not so recommended. Maybe it will be. I don't know. Maybe it's...
I'll tell you what it is. It's like if you go to the store and you get one of our staff picks and you got a couple of extra bucks. And you just got like, I got to get rid of this extra money. Then you get the you hit the bargain bin.
Yeah, exactly. So before we get into it, of course, patreon.com/learningtolisten. Guys, if you want to help us out, we'd really appreciate it. You know, you can spend your money on whatever. We get it. Things are tight. We get it. But if you got a couple of bucks and, you know, you like what we're doing, then help us out. Patreon.com/learningtolisten. Episodes go up early. There's a ton of bonus material. That's where you can get the archived episodes. It's the only place you're going to get them as they disappear off the main feed. So, look, that's all I'm saying. We're not just saying, you know, hey, give us a handout. There's something. You get some value for your money. We're putting it up there. Patreon.com/learningtolisten. Okay. So, the album is Passage. It's the 8th studio album by American popular music duo The Carpenters, released in 1977. It produced the hit singles All You Get From Love Is a Love Song, Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Craft, and Sweet Sweet Smile. Yeah. It's funny that this says hits. Because I don't know who's writing these. this Wikipedia article. But by the way, a little inside baseball. Usually I just read the first paragraph or so from the Wikipedia when I'm introducing the album. But I don't know if I would call any of these hits.
Are you kidding me?
Well, okay. Yeah. We're not talking taste yet. Well. We're talking about how well did they chart to be considered a hit. And when the only song that charted, I think, on... like that broke like the top 40 was on country radio and not actually the pop or adult contemporary or soft rock stations that the Carpenters were normally played ad nauseum on. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can call it a hit. Not in the way that hit songs, like we're talking the Carpenters here, right?
That's fair.
The Carpenters owned AM radio in the 70s, you know, pretty much from the time that like Close to You and We've Only Just Begun hit the charts. These guys were in the top 40 at least, if not top 10, from about 71 right up until around like 76, you know. Mm-hmm. You couldn't turn on the radio without hearing a Carpenter song in the rotation. But so somewhere along those lines their sales started to drop off a little bit, as anything would, you know. They were prolific, they were putting out tons of content, and also, you know, they're audience was probably aging out a little bit. And let's just be straight up, you know, this might be a little bit of opinion off the top here, maybe a little editorial, but they're super square. Super duper square. These are the squarest squares that have ever been square. And, you know, there's a point where, like, they were, even people who were fans of them were scared to admit that they were fans of them, because then you were just admitting that you were square.
Is it one of those things that was really cool and then it became uncool to like?
No, it was never cool.
Never, ever cool?
I think it was always just like safe, like, you know, like a good, nice, warm piece of white bread.
Yeah, these guys could not get signed in the 60s when they were really, really trying to get signed, because of their, even then, out of touch adult contemporary sound. You know, it was only pure talent that got them any attention whatsoever. And then they did have hits. It's not like they didn't have hits. It was just that at the time, think about like the 60s. Like, we were just listening to the Stooges, you know,
Funhouse.
Funhouse, thank you, Charlie. The 1970 record, right? And at that point, they were starting to take chances on bands like that because they were like, okay, like, you know, what was hitting in the mainstream? Psychedelic rock, you know, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin. Like, that's what kids were buying. Mm. You know, they weren't buying the Richard Carpenter trio, you know, like brother and sister duo, where they're just like this, like, mamby-pamby whatever. But
I kind of feel like they might be kind of like Nickelback, where everyone says they don't like them, but someone's buying the fucking album.
Who keeps buying these things?
Well, I think you're right. And I think that there was like a case of like, these guys got tons and tons and tons of like radio play in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Like, and you know what? I don't know about you guys. So maybe that's where we'll start. Like, to me, the Carpenters represent a bit of like that nostalgia for me, where if I was hanging out, say, with my grandparents or something, like in the summer, they'd have the radio on one of those AM radio, like oldie stations. And, you know, a song like We've Only Just Begun or Close to You, or I don't know, they had a myriad of hits, right, in that era, would be on all the time. I'd hear that stuff all the time. Plus, you know, there's a Christmas album or two that, like, my family was never a Carpenter's family, but, you know, they were in the rotation every once in a while. You know, there was like a cassette that got passed around a couple times. Like, I don't know, as kids, we never were like, who put that one on again? But it was around, you know. So that's, to me, that's my experience with the Carpenters. I know them of that era of, like, you know, I wasn't really alive for the Carpenters era. But so my experiences in like these oldies, moldy oldies, you know, adult contemporary soft rock stations. But what about you guys?
You know what? I think my mom kind of liked the Carpenters, because I remember her having a couple albums, like nothing like a huge discography. And I'm going to go see them later today, and I'm actually excited to show her this and be all like, hey, mom, did you have this one? Do you have this on vinyl? You know, but I definitely remember it being around. But she also listened to like Alice Cooper and stuff like that, right? So pretty big, you know, one side or the other. So
okay, Naomi, what about you?
I'm kind of having the same experience with that you had, because I listened to a few of the songs and I had some serious deja vu, and I was saying, I messaged my mom yesterday to say, did you have this album? Because I feel like I know everything on it.
Oh, really? Well, you do know everything on it, but we'll get into that. Even if you didn't hear this album or your mom didn't have it.
I know I wasn't a stranger to the Carpenters, so she must have had some Carpenters music, but yeah.
Well, there was, you know, in our era, growing up in the 80s, Karen Carpenter had passed away. Yeah. Tragically, she was probably one of the first celebrities to... not just suffer from anorexia, but like, since she had passed away from complications due to anorexia, like, she brought that to the main, like, to the light, to the mainstream. All of a sudden that became a conversation that, like, oh, eating disorders are a thing. And so posthumously, there was a lot of, like, you know, Carpenter's greatest hits records, lots of collections. Anybody who had any claim to any of the rights, were putting out tons of those. Like, you know, I remember being a kid and seeing a lot of like commercials for collections of Carpenter's albums and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They managed to put out four albums, like, official releases after her passing away too. Turns out she had been sitting on a solo album, that had been recorded by Quincy Jones, with Quincy Jones production while Richard Carpenter, her brother, was suffering. Well, let's say suffering. He was dealing with a Quaalude addiction and had gone to rehab.
Oh.
So in her downtime, she went and did her own. And then they decided not to release it because it was too drastically different from the Carpenter's regular catalog, right? Because it was full of like disco and you know, Quincy Jones production. And this is talking about an era where Quincy Jones is launching people like Michael Jackson. So imagine like his solo career. So imagine him getting his hands on some, but that stuff did eventually come out in a collection of unreleased stuff. They put out another Christmas album somehow, you know, that sort of stuff. So Carpenters were still kind of relevant in that thing. Here's what's ironic about that whole thing where the record label wouldn't release Karen Carpenter's solo album because it was too drastically different. The whole point of this album was to be drastically different from everything else the Carpenters had done, because they were basically having a bit of an identity crisis. Suddenly they weren't having the hit songs that they were, even though they were still getting some airplay or whatever. When you go from the top and then all of a sudden it's a little more tepid, you know, like people's tastes are changing, like disco's in full swing now.
Sure.
Outlaw country's in full swing now. Like progressive rock is in full swing now. Like the Carpenters were just getting left behind, right?
Punk.
Like,
punk. This went up against a lot of punk.
You know, punk was a thing, and like, yeah, you know, maybe punk wasn't quite mainstream yet, but like, you know, the tastes by the middle of the 70s had drastically changed. And also maybe the younger audience that these guys had gotten in the late, or I guess early 70s, had grown up a little bit right now, and their tastes were just different. They just, you know, they weren't there. They just weren't into the saccharine sweetness of early Carpenters. And so the answer to that was this album, Passage, which, yeah, I would have rather they put out a disco album myself, but I don't know. It's not that this wasn't interesting. I have to give a shout out to a YouTube channel that I frequent sometimes called Todd in the Shadows, because this is what threw it on my radar, is that he likes to pick albums. He has a series called Train Wreck Ords. And the idea is that he takes a group or an artist who has had a somewhat successful career, or at least had a handful of hits, and finds the album in their catalog that totally derailed them. And he pinpointed this one as the one that like basically was more or less the nail in the coffin for the Carpenters' popularity. And
is he the same one that you sent me with that Jordan Knight Give It To You video thing?
Yeah, so he has a different really series good. Of videos. That one is a one-hit wonderful.
Yeah,
yeah,
that was great.
And I like him because he's very fair, measured, or whatever. So, full disclosure, him describing this album, I was like, okay, I have to fucking listen to this thing. I have to know where the Carpenters, who went from, like, you know, why do birds suddenly appear, to singing about fucking like reaching out telepathically to UFOs. Like, where did that come from? Like, what were they trying to do? And so the reason I wanted to talk about our familiarity with the Carpenters as they had existed up until this point was because I just wanted to see what you guys thought about like how drastically different this was from the rest of the Carpenters catalog. You know, like, When you first hit play on this, I guess we're just going to get into some initial reactions. But when you first hit play on this, were you surprised right away, or did it take a while, or were you surprised at all? Like, what were your reactions?
I was expecting it to be weirder than what I had anticipated, but I didn't until the very last track. I thought it was kind of standard issue adult contemporary music.
Okay, but even when it starts with this song, Buona No, She No Home, okay, and Karen Carpenter's doing this kind of weird patois thing, and it's like, what is this song about? Like, you're the I guess in this case, matriarch of some kind of household. Like, are you a plantation owner? I don't understand. You're talking down, obviously the point of view of this song is that you're talking down to a servant.
Oh.
And telling them that what you have to say, like, okay, I didn't bring the lyrics up, but I'm going to look these lyrics up right now. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So first, yeah, the Buona Shino Home. I don't there. Exactly understand what Buona means, but this is a cover of a Michael Franks song.
Mm.
And in his version, it's a Buona Hino Home. And he's kind of playing a character. And if you listen to his version, you kind of understand a little bit better that he's being an intentional dick in the song. And he's being very condescending to this other person, this song, right? Mm. But yeah, Buona no Shino Home like lyrics. Okay, and so here's the thing is like, I don't know if it translates to this like very subtle, I guess, way that Karen Carpenter delivers the lyrics, you know, but the way she sings something like, let's see, I want you to speak the English right. I want you to smile and be polite, you know, say Buona no Shino Home. Like she's basically talking down to this like servant being like, anybody comes around here, anybody asks for me, you say Buona. You got this. Okay. Just, you can speak okay. English. This is all well, the this English is, you can pick.
That's pretty terrible.
Yeah.
That's this terrible.
This is what I'm saying. Like the first thing I hear is this thing. Song and I go, what the fuck? What the fuck is Karen Carpenter singing about? Why is she being like awful to a servant? What's happening? And so that's what I looked it up and I'm reading the lyrics and I'm like, they don't help. It's, you know, I don't care if you drive my 350, honey. Don't let them steal my chrome. I don't care if you spend all my money, long as you leave me alone. Okay, I mean, that's not so bad. But just this one line, I want you to speak. It's just so, it's
see,
like this weird.
This is the problem with me not paying attention to lyrics is that I miss what the song is saying.
You would have been driving around blasting this in your car and you'd be at the stop at a red light and
never.
Somebody would be like,
Buona. Buona Nishino Home. I mean, what if we're saying this word right
I'd
now
never,
and people are like,
I'd never play
God,
this.
That word is horribly racist. What are you guys doing? I'd have no idea, but I couldn't find what Buona itself meant. I could just find the lyrics of the song and I was like, But then I listened to the original version of this song by Michael Franks and I was like, oh, this makes more sense. This is a little more, I don't know if it's tongue in cheek per se, but he's like, he's playing up this character. It's kind of like, you know how, what's his face? John Misty, what's his, Father John Misty?
Oh, Father John Misty, yeah.
How he kind of plays like this, like arrogant character. Although sometimes he comes by a little too naturally, if you ask me. I think maybe he is that guy, and he just, instead of like trying to pretend he's not, he's just like, fuck it, I'm an asshole. I'm going to be an asshole on stage and make it part of my... Anyway, he sells it more in that way. Mm-hmm, whereas right. Karen Carpenter, you're like, it just doesn't sound right coming out of your mouth.
Well, I'm sure that when they were making this album that the producers were like, here, maybe you should use this material. And they were like, okay, like this is all right. And then
normally,
maybe just didn't quite get the...
Normally... Normally, Richard Carpenter wrote a lot of their material. They had some collaborators and other songwriters, and they did cover songs. I mean, famously, they would do like kind of these watered down versions of old pop and rock songs, right? But and they continued to do that after this. But in this case, they decided to not do that at all, not use any of their original material, and only use material brought to them by producers and songwriters and things like that.
Is this a cover album?
It kind of is.
In ways,
yeah. There's a couple of songs that weren't necessarily recorded, but like these they might have done the first recordings of them. But like, yeah, it's all other people's music.
But I don't think it was meant as a cover album.
No.
They didn't set out to make a cover album. They just set out to make an album. And then the songs that either the production company or that they landed on were covers, were like just other people's songs.
So I think the angle they were working with Buona Shino Home was that there was another scene happening at the same time that was just kind of in its infancy that we get to retroactively call Yacht Rock, right? But at the time, there was a lot of like, you know, people singing about islands and boats. And I think that they were just like, yeah, this kind of has that feel, right? Like maybe this is a sugarcane plantation or something. You know, they're like, yeah, let's get a Yacht Rock song on there. And let's open the album with a Yacht Rock song because it's 1977 and, you know, people are into fucking Cheeseburger in Paradise and bullshit. Like, right? So, like, why not? Yeah. You know, I think that's what they were going for here. This to them was their boat song, right? And they revisit that again later with Man Smart, Woman Smarter, which... Like, you know, it's a cheeky little song that's kind of funny or whatever. But, like, it was originally done by Harry Belafonte, you know, and it's, so it's got a little bit of a Calypso vibe, but I would say, I think they pull off the, they pull off Buona, like She No Home, the musical aspects of it a lot better. Like it wasn't too bad for like 70s easy listening. At least it was groovy, you know? Like, so I don't know. I kind of skipped over your reaction, Charlie, because we just kind of got into it right away. Mm. But like when you hit play and that's the first song you hear, like, you know, where was, you know,
I thought it was a, I thought, okay, this is a little weird. This is starting off on a weird foot for sure. Right. Mm-hmm. I would say out of the whole first side, because like, for me, this album is very much like side A is very different from side B. Side A has, even though it was a little yacht rocky, now that you mention it and I think about it, but the first three out of the four songs on side A didn't surprise me sound wise.
Yeah, well, when you get into the next song, All You Get From Love Is a Love Song, which is supposedly the kind of the hit,
the,
on this
the
album.
Quote big hit,
and it's the one that when you would see collections of Carpenter's out like songs later, you know, greatest hits albums and whatnot, it would usually make it on there. And when I hit play on this, like, you know, so Buona, She No Home, that really was like, what
it's a
the
weird start.
Fuck is happening here?
Yeah.
But I was like, all right, groovy, I get it. This is kind of like, this has also got a little bit of that adult contemporary of like, I don't know, who else was hot in that scene at the time? Barry Manilow, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe a Copacabana.
Yeah, for sure.
That sort of thing. So I get that there was a little bit of that flavor out there. So they were trying that. I'm like, I get what they were going for here. I think they picked the wrong song. Or at least maybe lyrically they could have picked some. Maybe just didn't age well. And maybe looking back on it, you know, from now in 2021. And
no,
going
lyrically,
like,
it's terrible. Awful.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay. But I was like, all right, I'm willing to go with this. This is definitely not a typical Carpenter's feel. Right off the bat. So they're communicating that they're going somewhere different in the album. But then you get into All You Get From Love Is a Love Song. And I'm like, okay, this is more typical Carpenters pop. Like, this is the upbeat side of the Carpenters. This is as upbeat as they almost ever get. Because even if they do get, like, more up-tempo or more upbeat than this, they make sure that they fucking water that down as much as possible. So this is about the best you're going to get from there. But something about when they try and bring in a little country influence into their music, where they just, I don't know what it is about these guys, but they do not have any feel for country whatsoever. And you hear that really, really badly later in the album. I think it's the song Sweet Sweet Smile.
And agree it's to just disagree. Like,
oh, okay. You think that this is the country you're into? You're like, this is what I needed. You know, meanwhile, like Waylon Jennings and like, you know, Willie Nelson are the hottest thing on country like radio at the time that this came out. You're going to pick the Carpenters? Is that what you're saying, Charlie?
I'm saying that it's very much, it doesn't sound like a Waylon track or something like that,
no,
obviously,
of course not,
right?
Of course not.
But was I surprised once we got halfway through Sweet Sweet Smile? And at first I'm like, oh, there's banjo in there. That's interesting. And then there's an actual guitar solo. And I was like, oh, there's a not too bad little country guitar solo in there.
So, okay. But I would say that has more to do with the fact that you're just like listening to the production on the rest of this album. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh.
Yeah. No, that's definitely it. It's based on, you know, its peers sitting right next to it on the album. Not like its peers on a global country music scale.
Mm-hmm.
But like, especially going from the first three, the first group of songs, which are all, you know, two of them are pretty standard sort of Carpenters type stuff. And then that one, the opener one, is a little weird. And then the closer on the first side is also like, okay, well, I know.
Okay, hold on. Let's get there. But in a moment, because I just want to say that I just love Fall in Love Again, even though that it starts off like I'm just like, oh, yeah, this is just very straightforward Carpenters fare. This is like album filler stuff. Mm. When it hits the key change and the guitar solo kicks in, it wins me the fuck over.
Now, was that like a super synthy kind of sound? What was it?
Well, it's fuzzed out. It's super fuzzed out. It's
right,
guitar.
Okay.
I don't know who's playing the guitar. Like, the fucking personnel list on this album is insane. I don't know how many people there are. I mean, the fact that they they credit the whole Philharmonic Orchestra that they brought in, plus the 50-person choir that they brought into this album under just over-budget Philharmonic Orchestra.
Well, there's a
reason
they did
still something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. Okay. There's like 40 fucking names of players on this beside the Philharmonic Orchestra.
I heard a number, and I'm not sure how correct it is. I never fact-checked it, but that they had like 160 people personnel on this album.
Oh, I would not doubt it at all. Did you guys not, like, this is probably the most overproduced record that I've ever heard in my life.
You know what's so cool? Ray Parker Jr. is on here.
Oh, there's a ton of names on here that you'd be like, guitar work. Sure, that guy. Yeah, I've heard that guy play on other tracks. Oh, yeah. This is, because they brought in every studio musician under the sun. Like, obviously, these guys have a budget. They had hits. The record company was willing to fucking, like, pay. They said that this record took 3 months to track and another 2 months to mix. So five months in production altogether. And I'm like, wow, I can't believe it didn't take longer. When you listen to like the instrumentation on these songs, like there's nothing that there's no space to breathe. The fact that they managed to make it all so like it doesn't just sound like a cacophony of noise at any point is really speaks well to the like the production, you know, and like how controlled the studio must be or must have been, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, but that fuzzed out guitar comes in and I just fall in love again. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, I was out of love with this album, but now I've just fallen back in love again. it won me over in that moment. And then, and then it goes on to track 4.
Track four, right?
Track four. Now, do you know what we're talking about here, Naomi?
Yes.
This is the Andrew Lloyd Webber, Tim Rice co-written. I don't know what do you call like the single from a musical, but it's from the musical Evita. It's not just Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. It starts with the on the balcony of the Casa Rosada stanza, the operatic part where, like, I don't know who's doing those vocals, but, you know, it starts with that. And then it goes into Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. And what's wild about that is not only, okay, maybe I've come around to, like, okay, this is, I see that the Carpenters are, like, stepping out of their comfort zone, but they're also still doing it in a very, you know, adult contemporary Carpenters way of being different by not being that different at all. But then this is just, like, why is this part of the identity crisis where they're like, I don't know, maybe we can use this as like a calling card, maybe Broadway will start coming calling and they'll start putting like Karen in like the lead of Broadway musicals or something, like was this a sneaky way to get this into, you know, certain people's ears or somehow, like what was the point of that? Also on top of that, this is the first publicly available recording of that song
ever.
I don't know. Okay, the story I heard was that Evita had not even been launched yet, that that Richard had just somehow got his copy on one of the cast and crew demo recordings as the show was being worked, like workshopped, right? Like, you know. And it's like maybe a producer brought it to him or something. Somebody was like, "Hey, you guys ever thought about doing something musical? This might be interesting." Anyway, so he got it and they managed to get the rights to record it and they brought in the orchestra,
the LA Philharmonic.
Yeah, but they weren't allowed to be credited that way for some legal reasons. But Peter Knight came in and he's the one who arranged it and recorded all the orchestrations and stuff like that. And it's so similar to what would end up being the final Andrew Lloyd Webber version that I wonder if sometimes that they didn't just take his sheet music and that's what they used for the final play or the musical or whatever.
Right.
But okay. It was certainly interesting, and I have to give it that 100%. I was like, okay, take me in a whole different direction now. Like, just fucking, let's just, you know, like, let's just take a 90-degree turn and go in a completely different way. But I don't, like, what the fuck? Like, what were you guys thinking at this point in the album?
Well,
why are they covering this?
I'm thinking, I was actually, that's where I realized I'm actually having a pretty good time hearing this for the first time ever, because I have no idea what's happening next.
Yeah.
You've lulled me into a false sense of security with that second song. And then, yeah, I do remember that fuzzy solo in the third song. And then this song, I was just like, yeah, I don't know what's happening anymore.
I was like starting to wonder if she was the original singer of this from the soundtrack or something. I was just like, why is this on here? How many times has this song been covered?
Yeah,
I remember Madonna doing it much later, because she was in the movie presentation of Evita. But I mean, like, I was like, who originally sang this anyway? Was it Karen Carpenter? I'm so confused.
Well, I guess maybe technically it was.
Maybe.
Because from what I've heard, and like I said, you know, I only do so much research. Don't worry. Like, I didn't spend days on this or whatever. But from what I've heard, that this was the first publicly available, like, commercially recorded version of this song. This was released before the cast recording would have been released. This is well before Madonna, you know, like, so well, I don't know how
many Gimme's version.
Well, yeah, like that came later too. So like, I guess this is the first time anybody would have heard Don't Cry for Me Argentina, unless the production made it to the theater. I'm not totally sure of that timeline.
Well, I guess I'd have to specifically look that song up.
But why the operatic stanza at the beginning of the song? Why not just go into Don't Cry for Me Argentina? Did they feel that they needed to set it up? Like, you know,
I kind of think that maybe Richard Carpenter, because I feel like for some reason I think that he had a pretty good, or at least he felt like he had a pretty good record collection, he had good taste, because he's also the one who brought in the last song, which I'm very excited to talk about later. And maybe he was just like, another thing, the bonus question that you put in our homework assignment was to watch that TV special.
We'll get into that.
By watching that TV special and some of the choices that he got to play on piano or whatever, I'm kind of like, yeah, he probably was like, no, this is great. We got to start with this.
Oh, boy. You didn't watch that whole special, though.
I only missed like 15 minutes of it, so I didn't miss very much.
Did you miss the song where I don't know if it was ever on any of the Carpenters albums, but where he sang about how, like, and now I'm playing the piano for you.
Was that the one where he's playing the see-through piano?
Yes.
Yeah, I sort of saw that one.
I don't know if he wrote that song, but if he wrote that song, how did he write any of these other songs? Somebody else wrote these songs, because that song is one of the fucking worst songs I've ever heard in my life. It's terrible. The lyrics are so bad. It's so like Little Kitty. It's so like it's all about how like I didn't go out and play basketball and football with the boys because I stayed at home playing my piano, but now I'm playing my piano on TV, so I guess I win. Oh, I didn't go on dates with girls because I stayed at home and I played my piano, but now I'm playing my piano on TV, so I guess I win. And he's like, but I'm playing it for you, and I'll try and sing good too. Like, those are actual lyrics. Those last thing, two things I said. Anyway, it's fucking god-awful, man. I can't believe that they were like, you know, we've been having a lot of success with these TV specials.
The special or just that song?
Specials in general. That was part of their bread and butter, was that they...
Do you mean that special or that song?
No, here's the thing is, that special... I guess we are kind of getting into it a little bit right now. That special, what was it called again?
Space Encounters, I believe. The Carpenter's Space Encounters special.
It was twofold. It was trying to capitalize on at the time there was like the Star Wars mania and everybody trying to like rip off Star Wars. Sci-fi movies were a real big hit. They even make a couple of Star Wars, Darth Vader, you know, references in that special. Anybody who's seen the Star Wars holiday special and knows just how bad that is, just imagine that the Carpenters had their own version of that. Except that at least they stuck to more music and less like, you know, people in Wookiee costumes like jerking off to holograms.
I mean, look, this special didn't have B. Arthur doing a 5-minute song, but it did have Suzanne Somers. So
I know, playing the Ditsy Plon from space. It was like, beam down to Earth, but I have nothing to wear. And then the fucking audience laughs, and you're like, what are you laughing at? That's not funny.
I thought that this special was excellent.
Oh, my God.
It was so bad, and it was so over the top. If you would have put Adult Swim on top of it, like just in the corner, I would have been like, I buy it.
Yeah. For its cringe factor.
But that's why I like that kind of shit. So that's why I thought it was awesome.
Okay. But like, be honest, you're cringing at it. That's one thing. But to be like satisfied, to be like, if you were a kid in 1977, right? It's Friday night and there's one TV in the house and you've got four channels. And you know that, like, you know, I don't know, some fucking kick-ass, like sci-fi horror movie is on another channel. But your parents are like, well, we're going to tune into The Carpenters tonight. You'd be like, no, please. So
of course you're angry at that.
Yeah. No, you're not going like, oh, yes. And if you are the kid who's like, yes, I can't wait to watch The Carpenters.
Then you're at home learning how to play piano and not out.
Yeah, and not getting, yeah, exactly, and not having girlfriends or, like, getting invited to play baseball.
However, there is maybe a little bit of solace in the fact that at least it's a weird sci-fi themed special and not some stupid Christmas special or just them sitting around in sweaters and a fire.
Yeah, but it's bad. And the choices they make in it are bad. And the songs they sing in it are bad. Here's the thing, too. They don't just do material from this album. They only do like two or three songs from this album. Mm-hmm. They base the whole thing around the last song of this album. Which
is brilliant and had me hook, line, and sinker.
Oh yeah,
we'll get to that. Let's get back to that.
But we're too far ahead. The thing is, we're still on side A here, and we've got track four.
On Evita.
And okay, so I have to say that I think her performance of Evita was very competent, mm-hmm. right? You know, mm-hmm. like I wasn't like, ooh, this is a real like mismatching. But there is one thing, and it's missing on a lot of this record, and maybe it's because Richard wasn't writing these songs. But Karen Carpenter is known for the lower register of her voice. She's got like a 3-octave range or something like that.
Contralto.
Yeah. And it's missing on this album. Did you guys notice that?
I can't say that I've heard a lot. Like I've definitely heard Carpenter stuff before, but I can't say that I've heard enough of it to pay attention to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the things that anytime you hear anybody comment about her voice, it's that she for her range, she's very competent in like the lower parts of her range. And in fact, to the point where they even used to joke that she was like all the real money's in the basement, because the singles that really charted and did well were the ones where she would spend at least some time in the song like contrasting like her higher vocals, like okay, so We've Only Just Begun. That first line of, hey, we've only just begun. Okay. She goes boo, 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 up her range. And it's that contrast of going from the low to the high that people were like, ooh, what's happening here?
Right.
Which in this one, especially on this song, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, she stays in her higher register for most of the song. And I think if anything, you know, I did read some criticism, even from the Carpenters themselves. Richard had said that, you know, at first he really thought it suited her really well, but now years later looking back, he was like, it didn't show her range at all. It just kept her in one register.
I mean, I agree that she sounded vocally competent to do the song, and I didn't hear her struggle with any higher notes. She's a good singer. I didn't hear any kind of a struggle, but I can see why they would say, oh, that wasn't her best sweet spot for her voice. Sure. You know?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I wanted to talk to you, Naomi, about the vocals in particular, because I find that I had a hard time. Like, her voice is definitely competent. She was a good singer. But did you find that it was kind of hard to really judge her vocals on this record because they were just so overlayered? Like, it sounds like at any point that she's singing, there's like 7 Karens singing at the same time. It's like, this is kind of, I don't know, like the original auto-tune or something like that, where they just oversaturated her vocal every time.
Instead of adding a reverb or a delay, they just kept layering it over and over and over. I didn't really notice that, to be honest. I've kind of just, I don't know. I actually really found the vocal track on many of the songs, like I Just Fall in Love Again and Sweet, Sweet Smile, I found them very soothing. As far as production goes, though, I didn't really notice it being over the top with layers or anything.
Well, I have to say, I didn't mind it. Like, I thought it was a good sound. I was like, this is, you know, like, this is really overproduced for sure. Like, way overproduced. Like, man, a couple of these songs would have benefited from some space, some breathing room. Maybe, you know, bring it down to just a piano and vocal arrangement. Like, it would have been nice to hear a few versions like that or something, like, you know, maybe a bar or two, maybe an intro that's a little more like that. Kind of like those are old Carpenters singles, but I guess maybe that's what they were trying to get away from, and they were like, let's just do everything all the time, always on this record. So I just thought it was a little bit of a shame because I felt like it didn't show off her vocal as much as it could have. Because there's definitely, on top of that, there's definitely reverb galore all over this thing, you know, and whatever. But, yeah, I don't know if this album would be the one that I would like if you wanted to showcase Karen Carpenter's vocals.
Sure.
It's not this record.
It's the album is too experimental to begin with to actually portray an accurate portrayal. Let's say that twice of what her voice can do. Yeah.
Yeah. I also found that she was kind of a notorious soft singer. She was a very close to the microphone singer, which is part of her style.
She's got an ASMR quality to her.
Yeah, totally. But it also showed because she was always closely mic'd and very hot mic'd. It, you know, managed to pick up a lot of the nuance in her voice, which was always very nice. But I found on this one, it was just very, like, everything subtle, you know, everything.
I wonder if there was a difference in her voice over the years from the time she started until the time she was getting sick, because she was obviously going to be weaker.
Maybe. You know?
She might not have been able to sing with as much power or range or whatnot because she might not have had the actual strength to do so.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I do know that. So when they started, when her and her brother started playing music together and trying to play it professionally, they had started as a trio called the Richard or sometimes Dick Carpenter Trio, right? And she was the drummer in that group.
Mm-hmm.
And she was not the original lead singer. At some point, though, they had decided that she would just handle the lead vocals. And she was singing from behind the drums. And I wonder what effect that had on her singing style. Like, she felt like she had to get in close to a microphone because otherwise she had bleed from the drums all the time.
Oh, maybe.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so she just got really comfortable. In fact, when they started recording, she would still play drums on the Carpenters albums and even when they played live for quite a while. But then one of the criticisms they would get is that because she was a diminutive woman, like, I mean, on top of the fact that she was, you know, crazy skinny and unhealthy, like, I think at her heaviest that she ever weighed was 120 pounds or something like that.
Yeah.
And she was mortified to find out that she weighed 120 pounds. She thought she was just like as big as a house. By her death, she had gotten herself down to like 89, 90 pounds, something like that. Yeah. She was, not in the right mindset, but anyway, she was a diminutive woman in the first place, maybe about 5'4" or whatever. And people would complain that even on a drum riser, they're like, we can't see the singer. We can't see the girl singing. So slowly but surely, they brought her out from behind the drums and they got her to get in front of the... But she at first was terribly anxious because, you know, you're surrounded by drums. It becomes kind of... It's like, you know, playing a guitar. It's like, it doesn't seem like that much, but all of a sudden somebody's like, hey, put the guitar down and sing. And you're like, I need my thing in my hands.
What do I do with my arms and hands? And
So she was very... And that, I think maybe some of that... Like, she's obviously very self-conscious and had some other issues too, but that might have led to a bit of her anxiety was, like, just being so exposed and so out there.
Yeah.
So I think the close singing thing, like being right into a microphone, might have been part of the fact that she was behind the drums. It's interesting too. So she doesn't drum on this album at all. They're like, nah, no drums for you. Richard doesn't write anything. They end up with songs like, you know, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. Already on the first side, you've had Boat Rock. You've had, you know, pop songs. You've had a musical. So right off the bat, the very first side is like, God damn, this is like Identity Crisis, the album. But then, yeah, side two, Sweet, Sweet Smile, which is a co-write from Juice Newton.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I believe that's the country song, right?
That's the country one, yeah.
The, like the one that's like exclusively.
I
mean,
I guess I wouldn't even call it country. I'd just call it soft rock country.
Well, yeah, it's definitely a pop. It's weird because, you know, we talk about how a lot of country music on the radio today is pop music with, you know, maybe some country references or instrumentation on it. Like, this is very guilty of that, but at least it was coming from a pop band.
Yeah, legitimate, like, pop country, because it was first and then just.
Yeah, here's us playing our version of country.
Yeah.
Well, Juice Newton was like that too. Like, Queen of Hearts is kind of like a country pop song.
Totally. You're not wrong about that. You're not wrong about that. I would say that the difference is that there's more of a genuineness to Juice Newton's performance. Plus, it's a little rock and roll, you know, like there's it sounds like, you know, a band playing a song. It doesn't, this, like, whereas this sounds like, you know, I don't know. This whole album to me, maybe, did you, it does seem like some weird, like, off-brand, like, soundtrack to, like, some, you know, not a Disney musical, like, but maybe, like, a Don Bluth.
You know what it kind of felt like to me? And here's the note that I wrote down. It made me think, it felt like a Harry Nilsson sort of a record. Because what he does, except the fact that he writes the songs on his, he writes half of his songs. But like on a Harry Nilsson record, the styles just go all over the place, you know?
Yeah, but for the most part, Harry Nilsson doesn't sound nearly this overproduced. Ever.
Oh, for sure. No, but I just mean in the stylistically.
Yeah. But Harry Nilsson sounds like the kind of songs that any like buddy could like sit down at a piano or pick up a guitar and like work out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do a reasonable facsimile of it, or even, you know, put it together, a small band, four pieces maybe, and be able to pull off. I don't think any of this sounds like you could be like, hey, let's work this out. Let's do this for the bar band set. Hey, you know.
I mean, maybe Sweet Sweet Smile, because it was the most, I think, this regular, you know, sort of song structure.
Yeah, I don't know. And then Two Sides is a very forgettable song.
I was just going to say, I don't remember anything about that.
I totally forgot that song already. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very, album
decided
cut. I like right now trying to think of it. I cannot bring it to mind at all. I can remember, like, some maybe of the,
was
the
a
lyrics.
Super synthy. Was there a super synthy solo or something on it? Or maybe some crazy electric piano?
I don't know. Maybe. I feel like it was just one that they were like, yeah, these lyrics will work. And then the lyrics are kind of dumb. So then we get to the Calypso song. Man smart, woman is smarter. So anyway,
so there's that.
So there's that. I don't know. It was cute. It's cute. This is one of the songs they did for that TV special.
Mm-hmm.
So it was Karen Carpenter and Suzanne Somers singing it. I mean, she did a good lip sync, but it sure didn't sound like her voice.
Okay, but nothing on that. I mean, obviously nothing on that.
Well, they didn't do anything live on that, but I'm saying, like, I wonder who sang Suzanne Somers' part.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know what they were going for there. I mean, is this meant to be more of the yacht rock like we were talking about earlier? Because I think this misses the mark.
More of a calypso, more of like the Harry, like they're just like, well, let's just cover some Harry Belafonte.
Like maybe they were trying to get into the world music market. Yeah. They were like, we need more world music. Was that a hot scene at the time, you think? You know, like Harry Belafonte was popping off in the early 60s when there was a need for authenticity in folk music.
Mm.
And then people were like, oh, well, what about folk music from around the world?
Right.
Famously, Joan Baez called Harry Belafonte Hera Belafoni.
No.
Because,
spite.
Yeah. She thought that he was, he wasn't the real deal, genuine thing, that he was putting on an accent and all that. So, who knows? I don't agree with her. I mean, she could be right, but I mean, Hera Belafonte was great.
She was great.
I enjoy everything I ever heard. I mean, as a kid, man, his music appealed to me because it was just fun and singing about tarantulas hiding in bananas and stuff. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah, you know, that's fun, you know? Yeah. Hurry up, tally man, tally me banana. But in this case, man smart, woman smarter. I don't know. Does Karen Carpenter sell the performance?
Eh. I don't know about that.
Yeah. You guys weren't like, oh, I'm going to throw this on at my next cocktail party.
I'd say it was at this point in the album where I was almost ready to be like, okay, all right, good. We can wrap this up. All right, we're done here, right? We're done with all the surprises, aren't we?
Well, okay. If you guys are ready to get into it, then I think this is the song that the album really need to talk about. Yeah. And it was the lead single. Mm-hmm. It was the whole point of that TV special was that they were like, let's base our TV special around this single because that's what's hot right now. We need a sci-fi themed prog rock, Beatles-esque, I don't know, whatever, song about reaching out to UFOs telepathically to tell them that we are your friends. And so in a Star Wars era, they for some reason decided to record the song written by Canadian prog rockers, the band that was often thought to be, you know, wrapped up in this myth that they were actually the Beatles.
Mistaken forming. For the Beatles.
Well, and they decided to go with it because what awesome marketing is that, you know, there's a conspiracy theory that you're actually secretly the Beatles got back together, but don't want to be the Beatles. So you called yourself Klaatu and left a bunch of, anyway, yeah, the band is Klaatu. Klaatu, being one of the, words spoken, by the alien that comes to Earth in the day the Earth stood still. This song is called Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Craft. And yeah, it's an 8-minute song, although some of that is, you know, the very beginning of the song where they are doing a bit of a skit about aliens calling into a radio station on a request line.
Which is so excellent, by the way, because not only am I already sold off the bat, but then the very last thing the alien says, I think, is like, baby.
Baby, yeah.
I was like, oh, hell yes.
Mimicking the radio announcer. Now, listen, if you're listening to this, and I wish we could put clips in this thing, and maybe we'll figure out how to do that someday, but I will not be hurt if you just pause this right now and you go find the song Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Craft. Sorry, it's a mouthful. And just, you know, put 8-10 minutes aside, hit play on that, listen, and then come back and listen to the rest of this conversation because you, what the hell? What?
Please, huh? Press pause, go check it out, come back. Trust me.
Okay. Now, Charlie, I feel like you got enthusiastic about this album the minute you heard about that track. Did you just skip everything and go listen to that first before you listen to the album? Or did you sit patiently and make it to this track?
I knew about Klaatu before, but yeah. I'd never really heard the track so much. I heard, like, I know about them, but I never actually heard it. So I didn't skip straight to the end, even though it had the coolest name. You look at the lit titles and that's the coolest name. No doubt. That's going to be awesome. Right. But I was already, like I said, first listen through, I didn't do any reading or anything about it. I was kind of hanging out doing, like, you know, doing some cleaning or whatever around the house. And when this track came on, I had already finished writing off the album. I forgot that there was this track on it. And I was like, all right, whatever. We're almost done. One more. Here's the home stretch. All right, here we go. And then this, like, set was 7.5-minute long track. Blew my mind. And I was like, okay, change my mind. I'm now all in on this album.
yeah, okay. Naomi, when you got to this track and all of a sudden they're singing about how, you know, if you can close your eyes and concentrate your thoughts, that you can, you know, if you repeat the words that they sing, that you'll be able to reach out to spaceships. Oh, you
starting
know.
To wonder if they were in a cult. Was this a cult thing? Like, was it like suggestively trying to make us like look for aliens? Like, why is this happening?
Why is this happening?
Because it's 1977. Star Wars is the hottest thing in the world.
Which makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everything is sci-fi themed right now. like, you know, let's find a track that we can afford that, you know. So Richard Carpenter had said that because he had heard the theory that Klaatu was actually the Beatles, that he went out and bought a copy of their album. I don't remember what it's called. It's like a number or something like that. Mm-hmm. And just to hear it for himself. And then he was like, and, you know, definitely very Beatles inspired, very Beatles-esque in some cases. He was like, it was clear to me that it wasn't not actually the Beatles. But then I heard this song and he's like, I just fell in love with it. And I thought I could, you know, bring it to the studio and see what we could do with it. And he was like, and of course on their version, a lot of synthesizer, a lot of like Mellotron or whatever. He was like, I wanted to replace all of that with like strings and pianos and of course Karen's vocal. And, you know, he was a really championing the hell out of this song. I think he thought he was going to blow people's minds, like just blow them away. This was the single. He pushed for it. He wanted this. They marketed that whole fucking TV special around this track. That's why the whole thing was a, you know, UFO themed.
It sounds like he was trying to fulfill some kind of fantasy for himself.
But I also think maybe he got swept up in the whole, like, we need to hit this market while it's hot, and just really talked himself into it. Was like, we're going to do it. This is the pulse, baby. This is what everybody wants, you know?
Maybe even they thought, hey, if we ever get to make contact with UFOs, that they are going to listen to this song and we're going to be okay. We're going to be friends with them because of our song.
Yeah. Well, there was something about people, like they were talking about campaigning this to be the theme for like World Contact Day, which was supposed to be.
It says it right in the song though, right?
Yeah. World Contact Day. To make that an official, like a real thing, you know, like this is also the era of, you know, Spielberg too, not just George Lucas, but Spielberg and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You know, in a couple of years you would have Alien, which is definitely the antithesis to this song.
And not the friendly aliens.
You know, but this is more of the idea of like little green men and, you know, fucking silvery jumpsuits, like popping out and saying, take us to your leader or whatever.
You come in peace.
Well, they say that many times in this song. They say, we are your friends.
We are your friends.
Like the thing is, okay, if this is supposed to be some kind of prog rock or whatever, where's the rock?
Like, and that guitar solo.
Yeah, the guitar solo is all right, but like overall, man, I was like, really, this is the song of just like, I was like, okay, if this is the tent pole song on this album, it's weird that you put the lead single at the very last song, but I get it. They're like, well, let's build up to this. It's the weirdest thing we've ever done. It's the most, I would argue that Don't Cry For Me Argentina would be even further out of left field than this one, but they're like, okay, we need the, you know, to people to listen to the whole album. And if they've listened to the whole album up to this point, then we know they're on board and this is what we'll give them. I was kind of like, meh. Like, this is not what I wanted. I thought it would be more. I thought there would be more to it. I thought with the huge lush arrangements and stuff like that, I'd be like, oh, this is, yeah, I just want to drop acid and listen to this song repeat or something. You know,
it's too bad music videos weren't a thing back then. Good thing they had the special.
They were.
It's a good thing they had the special.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, that's just it. They did have the special. It didn't sell this album. It didn't sell this song. Nobody played this. Nobody wanted it. Nobody liked it. Here's the thing. I do have to say that the melody to this song is fucking catchy as all get out. It's been stuck in my head for days. I've listened to this album maybe two or three times
Nickelback.
Over the last few days, and I do catch myself singing "Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Space."
I love
calling it. Calling occupants of interplanetary most extraordinary craft. Like, it's such a weird word. It's such a weird mouthful, but it's just as catchy when you hear the original version.
That's just it, right? Any of the catchiness doesn't really come from the Carpenter's version of it. It comes from the Klaatu version.
Yeah, the only thing that these guys managed to do for this song was that because they had the money, the budget or whatever, the production is obviously of higher value, of higher quality. But then again, they did the Carpenter's or the rest of this album thing that they did to all these songs, and they just overproduce it. And then meanwhile, you go back and you listen to the original and you hear the two vocalists. On this one, I believe there was a woman who sang on it as well. Maybe that's what put it, the idea in his head that Karen could sing it.
No, that was the drummer. I found like a 7-minute clip of him talking about the song. Well, it, like he runs down the vinyl,
and he was just singing in a high register.
Yeah, he's like, "This part's me."
Oh my god, that's later hilarious!
Me and the singer just go back and forth. The sound effects at the beginning, he just had like a sound effects record that he had put on. He's like, "I had the sound effects record, and we wanted it to be like this person goes walking through." It was. They were kind of taking a jab at like getting stuff played on commercial radio. And so they wanted the idea to be this guy's just walking through a forest and he finds a turntable and he turns it on and puts the needle down. And this is the song that plays kind of thing. That's why it starts off all like foresty,
Oh yeah. It does have weird on the original, not on this Carpenter's version.
And the Carpenter's when they, instead of having the weird forest intro, they have the
radio DJ thing,
which makes more sense because it's much more Carpenters to have a 70s radio. All right, baby, speak up closer to the microphone so I can hear you. What's your request? You know?
Yeah, and then they just throw a weird vocoder thing on the vocals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we are observing your earth. it's wild. I mean, you know what? Like, I got a kick out of it. I'm not going to say that I was like, fuck this bullshit. I was like, all right, you guys, you're putting a smile on my face. I'll give you that much. But when I did go ahead and listen to the original version later, I was like, yeah, you know, if these guys had the budget to do, like, to get this song a little more dialed in, a little tighter, I like this version a hell of a lot more.
Well, of course.
And I like
the
Carpenter's version. Just, you know. It's just weird to me that this is their idea of, like, you know, really, like, really getting out of their comfort zone, really expanding their minds, going, like, we're going to blow people's minds, and then they just water it down is all they really do.
Well, that's just like anything. That's like when I said that I thought that one song was a good country song. It's not a country song. It's a Carpenter song with some country on it. And this is not a prog rock song. It's a Carpenter song with some prog rock on it.
Well, have you ever heard the Carpenters cover Hank Williams?
Oh, no, not that I can think of.
Oh, it's like about as like, I don't know. It's about as appetizing as boiled like chicken skin or something.
The Captain's
like,
Boil?
Captain's Boil matter.
Captain's Boil. Well, no, the Captain's Boil is delicious.
I love the Captain's Boil.
Well, if you're allergic to fish.
Stinky feet.
I'm allergic to fucking watered down, poorly produced, white, like, fucking bread music, you know?
You must have needed some medicine listening to this.
Well, so, you know what? Okay, we're at the end, you know? Normally, sometimes when we do these bargain bins, we just talk about that whole album. We don't really break it down by track, but this one seems to deserve more of a track for track. So, okay, we've gotten through the whole thing. Knowing that this is the one that kind of put the nail in the coffin for the Carpenters, you know, that they were never cool, but if anything, I think that this is the mistake of this album, is that instead of winning new fans, this just got rid of their old fans.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They lost fans instead of gaining fans.
They alienated them.
Hey.
Oh. I feel like Andrew Scott.
Yeah, so here's the thing. If you were a big Carpenters fan in the 70s and you were brought on board by, you know, like the first half or the majority of their career up to this point, and you put this one on, I get why you might be like, what the fuck? You know? But also, if you're already a fan of, you know, if you're so hip that you know about a band like Klaatu at the time or something like that, you know, or you're just into whatever else going on at the time, disco and you know, like outlaw country and fucking like Dio fronting Black Sabbath and shit like that. Like, are you gonna be like, you know, that new Carpenter's album really turned my head?
Slaps.
Like, no, you're not, right? So, like, who is this for? I guess is the big question at the end of the day.
The production,
self-indulgent.
The production company. Yeah.
Look, this is it. I think there's a review I read somewhere that summed it up pretty nicely where they were like, yeah, it was an admirable effort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it showed what they were capable of in the studio, you know, that they definitely were talented, you know, but like, who's this for?
It's not for anybody.
It's a self-indulgent project, I think.
Yeah. Like, I had a thought while listening to it, though, a couple times. So I'll have to say, I fell in and out of love with this record while I was listening to it, because there'd be something where I'd be like, you know, right off the top, the lyrics, and I'm like, what are you doing? And then, you know, the next song, I'm like, okay, well, run of the mill, middle of the road. And then there'd be something that I'm like, oh, completely forgettable. But then, oh my God, where'd that guitar solo come from? And then I'd be like, oh, now you're making me listen to opera. Okay. Oh, I'm listening to Evita. What the hell? Like, I didn't put on Evita. I didn't put on that kind of record. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I was pulled along. I was pulled along. I kept listening. Like, it was never not that. Like, every once in a while, I'd be like, all right, now you're not interesting. You're boring. But that would be the worst thing about it, would be that, you know, that would happen. I did have this thought, though, is that the Carpenters in the 70s are proof of why we needed punk rock. You know, like, that punk rock was inevitable. Yeah. Like, because just, you know, like, that you needed the antithesis of the Carpenters. You needed something that was the exact opposite to just, like,
isn't that how music is secular like that? Something has to wipe clean the slate from what was before it.
Yeah, it's like when like, you know, the hair metal scene in the 80s got so overwrought and oversaturated that, yeah, Nirvana comes along and everybody's like, oh, finally. Like,
yeah, you know? Exactly. It's yeah, it moves forward to something completely different.
Yeah, totally. When production values in the 70s were just like getting out of hand, and you have albums like this coming out where you need 40 people plus an orchestra plus a 50-person vocal choir, you know, to make your record. Like, yeah, three or four dudes who can barely string together a couple of chords just sounds like a breath of fresh air, right? Like, you're just like, yeah. Oh, glad to know that, you know, that exists too. Because could you imagine also how daunting it would be to be a young person who wants to make music and you're like, oh, like, yeah. I have to be able to, like, write music for, you know, like a whole Philharmonic Orchestra just to, like, get my songs on the radio? Or I have to be, you know, Jimmy Page and fucking play, like, you know, guitar solos that you have to pack a lunch for? Like, yeah. Huh. So anyway, that was my thought. I don't know. What do you guys?
I think that, like, it wasn't that we need punk rock. I think they were directly going up against punk. So I did like, what's a quick 30 essential punk rock albums of 1977. And you've got, like, you know, Blondie, The Clash, Elvis Costello, The Damned, The Dictators, Iggy Pop, The Jam, Ramones. This is all stuff that's happening. Talking Heads, Television, Marquee Moon came out that year. Like, this is all stuff that was happening at that year. So it was just like,
well, interestingly enough, though, I wonder in that first initial year, that Spirit of 77 year, if, like, collectively those records, because individually those records probably still didn't even outsell this one, right? You know, but I wonder if, like, collectively as a scene happening, I wonder if they managed to outsell it, because that was not the mainstream. That was, you know, New York underground, you know, sure, people who knew, but, you know, maybe some college stations were starting to play that stuff, but the Carpenters weren't college rock. The Carpenters were mainstream, top 40, AM gold. They were adult contemporary. They were on the pop stations. You know, they were soft rock and light. Do you remember when we used to have stations that would be like 780 light?
Yeah.
You know, like, and then they just play like fucking, like, sail away, sail away, sail away.
QT880.
Yeah. I remember, do you guys remember MG1200?
Yeah.
In our region, it was an oldie station on AM. Yeah, that's the one. Between that and CFCW, the two that my grandparents would switch between.
Before it was News Talk Radio, 880 was QT880, and it was all soft rock. From the 70s,
all soft
80s,
rock all the time.
And now,
a lot of songs about sailing, sailing, sailing away with you. Yeah, and then you, and then there you have the Carpenters, and then nobody ever played Buona Nishino Home.
I mean, I'm sure somebody did. I don't know.
Somebody did. Well, what do you guys think? Does it deserve the bargain bin?
Yeah.
Yes.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's like this. I think it's like, first song, don't listen to it. It's racist. It's fucking awful.
Skip it.
And the rest of it's just kind of average adult contemporary stuff. Yeah, the weird Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. Putting a musical song is kind of weird in the middle. Yeah. And then the last song is Whoa, What the Fuck Is This? So that's my thoughts. And
that was the journey you went on.
I don't think I'm going to listen to it again. Nope. Not interested.
You know what it's going to be for me? It's going to be an interesting footnote that I might bring up, like, to be the guy who's a little bit smarter at a party, to be like, well, have you ever heard their 1977 album Passage? I mean, they did put out one more album, I believe, after this, but then Karen died. And other than that, the only thing that they put out was a Christmas album.
Right.
And I don't know if that album, but like, yeah, things were really, the wheels were falling off at this point. It wasn't long after this that Richard, you know, like, he went to go get treatment for his addiction to Quaaludes. And what a 70s thing to be addicted to.
Yes.
Quaaludes. Ludes, man. Fucking ludes. Karen was obviously really struggling with her weight and her anorexia. Whether or not she was diagnosed at that point, I don't know if she even knew what she was doing. But then also she ended up in like some whirlwind marriage that eventually fell apart. And, you know, it's sad that this kind of is a little bit of a footnote in, you know, the end tale of the Carpenters, because I feel like the Carpenters overall definitely deserve their place in the pantheon of artists, and you know, some of their songs are essentially standards, you know? And people who are young in this era that eventually went on to have music careers of their own, like everybody from fucking Courtney Love to Madonna and even Gwen Stefani, all cited Karen Carpenter as like a huge influence on them when they were young, which makes a lot of sense, right? Especially, I guess, Madonna, since she literally went on to do Evita. I wonder if this is what the seed that planted that in her brain. It was like, eventually I want to do that. Evita. Who knows? But yeah.
I like Madonna's version of it. Side note.
Bargain bin for sure.
Well, here's what I think. I mean, I feel like, not knowing anything about it going in, the first listen was actually really fun because it was such a roller coaster, right? Mm-hmm. So that, if I paid $5 for this album and got it whenever, I would have been like, okay, well, that's interesting. But then you're never going to listen to it again, except for maybe to pull it out for, like, you know, that last song or something.
Yeah.
Right. So that's absolutely exactly what a bargain bin album is.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. If you bought this for $1, $3, $5 or whatever, and then, you know, I wouldn't say you wasted your money. It's worth a curiosity spin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right.
And as far as, like, you know, what their fans might have been doing at the time, So what we were talking about it earlier, I actually texted my mom and I was like, hey, have you ever heard of this album? Was this one of the Carpenters albums that you knew? And she was like, nope, never heard of that one. So I think at the time their fans had already been like moved on. And that's why they took this big of a swing to be like, I don't know, we got to do something. Here's a whole bunch of stuff. Maybe something will stick. You know,
I think that, I think it's a little bit of what I was saying before, for sure, where it's like, this didn't win new fans. It just lost old fans.
Well, I don't even think it lost old fans. I think
they were already losing fans, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, you know, at this point,
a bit of a scramble, try to get them
back. Yeah. If you had come on board earlier in the career, by this point, you know, it's been a few years, tastes have changed, mm-hmm. you know, disco's a thing. The Carpenters were all they were definitely probably the band that it was cool not to like.
Right.
Or the group or whatever you want to say. So this might have been a little too late for them anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of they should have just kept doing their thing and aged out with grace. But their story ended up tragic. So sorry, Naomi, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. It's just like he said when he had contacted his mom. I thought that maybe my mom had this album because when I heard I Just Fall in Love Again and Sweet, Sweet Smile, that I had already knew these songs from somewhere.
Mm.
So that's why I asked my mom, did you have this? But I don't think she did. Her response was, no, that doesn't look familiar.
I don't know that one.
So yeah, I don't know. It was kind of a weird deja vu. I don't know why.
Yeah. So it even flew under the radar for people who would have been into this band.
Yeah.
Like, because even that TV special, most of the music on that TV special was not off this record. It was older songs or...
It was all kinds of stuff.
It was interesting. Naomi, did you happen to... I just threw it in. It wasn't real homework or anything. It was just bonus points. So, Charlie, good job for getting most of the way through it.
I had originally dropped off about
10 minutes in, and then I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to buck up and finish this thing.
We'll see.
Sorry, I didn't score on that. This is the biggest thing
for me from the album is... Calling Occupants. I will listen to that again. I will for sure listen to their version of it again and the Klaatu version of it again, for sure. Other than that, I can't wait for the next time that I'm hanging out with someone or people are hanging out and just like maybe sharing some YouTube videos or something like that. And I'm like, oh, hold on. And I'm going to put that special on and it's going to be awesome.
Well, I'll tell you what, that special is good fodder for like one of those Zoom bad movie nights where it's instead of watching a full movie, you just watch like one short thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
absolutely.
Yeah. I would put up this in that,
the smoke list. Up a little bit and put that on or have a couple of drinks and put that on. It's going to be a good time.
It's probably not as bad as the Star Wars Christmas special. So
no, because I wanted to keep watching it. The Star Wars one was like, God, how long is this going?
We were falling asleep during that Star Wars one.
You might fall asleep during this one too, but it's just not as egregious as all. All right, guys. Well, there you go. There's the Carpenter's Passage. So thanks everybody for joining us today. I think maybe if you guys are game, once we're done here, maybe we'll have a little listening party if you're down. Just a quick one.
I've got maybe time for like a track, maybe.
A track.
I gotta go. Sorry.
Okay. Well, then I was hoping to entice our patrons at patreon.com.
Gotta start earlier.
Well, we just had so much to talk about. We went a little long on this episode. It was actually really surprising.
Really good.
Ignore everything I said. Don't go to patreon.com. Don't give us extra money to hear that little listening party.
I'll go hear the earlier stuff. We said stuff.
These guys shot down all my plans for that. But it doesn't matter. We do have tons of bonus stuff up there. There's also, you know, episodes come out early on Patreon. That's the only place you can hear our archived episodes. So make sure patreon.com/learningtolisten. And if you want to follow along and find out what we're going to be doing on this, we're going to be talking about more Rolling Stones, greatest albums of all time.
How far away from the button? Sorry.
Surely you're supposed to have it on the button all the time. So when you say that, you can. There we go. We'll be talking about Missy Elliott soon. I think we're going to, you know, have to do after the Carpenters, we're going to have to do a little bit more punk rock. So be talking to a friend or two about the Descendants album, Milo Goes to College. But if you want to know what we're up to and keep up with us and, you know, just say hi and all that sort of stuff, go to our social media. We put all our social media in one place. So you can find that on our website. Our website is...
L2LPodcast.com.
Right on. And if you're just lonely and you need to reach out and talk to somebody, well, it'll be a machine. But maybe we'll play you on the show. Who knows? You know, we're just going to keep plugging this until somebody caves in and does it. I get it. I know.
Just call us.
It's weird. It's weird. Nobody uses phones anymore for actually talking. But we do have a phone number. Naomi, what is that phone number?
780-851-8785.
Oh, man, I like it. I feel like I'm on a Carpenters album. Surrounded by you two. Okay, well, Charlie, Naomi, I know you guys got stuff you'd like to plug too. So, Charlie, what do you got going on?
Just go down to oldmandesign.com and get some merch. Get some L2L podcast merch. Get a mug, get a t-shirt, get all kinds of shirts. Just come on. Just do it. It's fun. All right. I'll see you there. Tell them Crazy Charlie sent you.
All right, oldmandesign.com. Naomi, what do you got going on?
I have a podcast called Dope Nostalgia where we talk to people who were big in the 90s and about them. And I'm excited because this week my guest is the metal queen, Lee Aaron.
Oh, fuck yeah. Right on. Lee Aaron rules.
Yeah.
Hey, didn't we make a reference to Lee Aaron a little while ago on something?
Possibly.
I can't remember what it was now. I think we were talking about Taylor Swift or something. Anyway, whatever. I just remember we mentioned Lee Aaron. Look at that. We made her appear.
There she is.
So there you go. Did you say her name three times in a mirror or
manifest it?
That's exactly what happened. Yeah.
Manifest. Great on. Okay, guys. Well, that's been our episode for today. So, you know, you'll see us again in a week or so. But thank you so much for listening and hanging out with us. We really appreciate you. You know, just lots of love. That's all I got. I got lots of love. All right. Okay. And now I'm gushing. So let's get out of here. Rap, rap, rap.
The 1990s. The music was fun,
yeah.
And then it got really dark for a while, a little bit anti-establishment.
But the next thing you knew, it was totally fun again.
So many artists came and went and left us wondering, what are they doing now? This podcast isn't about the heavy hitters who are still making millions. It's about everyone else, the ones whose careers didn't really leave that decade and kind of just still live in our memory.
So you mean Vanilla Ice had another song?
We all know what happened to Marky Mark. But what about the Funky Bunch? Who were the KLF? And why did Tammy Wynette record a song with an electro dance band that topped the charts? Two genres that specifically defined the 90s. What were freestyle and New Jack Swing all about? Did you know that Blossom star Joey Lawrence had a huge pop hit? Or that Alanis Morissette had a really hot pop career in Canada before Jagged Little Pill? Special guests will also be joining me to discuss the great era of glitter, grunge, thin eyebrows, hammer pants, and total ridiculousness. We're even setting up some interviews with some of the musicians that define the times.
Okay, so if you're older than 30, you might be sitting here going, man, I totally remember that song, but I have no idea who does that. Well, then you better listen and find out.
I'm Naomi Carmack, host of the Ultimate 90s podcast, Dope Nostalgia. You're going to be busting the move again, coming in early 2020. You want to follow us so that you know when we go live? Check out our Twitter at NostalgiaDope. Or you can find us on Instagram at dope_nostalgia. If you've got a question or you just want to be on the show, email us at dopenostalgiapodcast@gmail.com.